Okay. We'll move forward. We'll close the door, thanks. So welcome, everyone. Welcome to this chug, and I welcome to you in general. And we'll start tonight's chug with an interesting question. Why study listen? And that may seem like a rhetorical question, and in many respects, it may be, in 2018. But for hundreds of years, it wasn't rhetorical. It was a real question. And that question came to a head in the early part of the 19th century when the Musar movement actually evolved. The Musar movement was started by Rabbi Shaul Salanter, and the premise was that in an ever-changing modern world, and clearly the shift from the ancient world to the modern world is felt very acutely in the end of the 18th century, early 19th century, science is evolving, politics are evolving, industry, people feel as if the ground from under them is shifting. We can no longer assume that simply studying the word of Hashem will cascade into moral improvement, piety, humility. And the suggestion and the bold assertion of Rabbi Saul Salanter and his students, and he saw this as a revolution, he was conscious of that revolution. He writes letters to his students urging them to advance this revolution because it may meet with some resistance, is that time, and remember, time for Yeshiva Bachur and time for anyone is very, very sacred. It's very, very, you protect your time. You don't waste your time. The time that you can spend studying Dara and the Dvar Hashem should be delegated for frontal moral consideration. What does Yirat Shamayim mean? Why do we believe? How to improve our midos, our interaction, our mitzvah performance? This was met with a lot of resistance. For about 80 years in the yeshiva world, people were unsure whether this is Bittul Torah or something real and genuine. Of course, history has rendered its verdict. Our world is too complex to just assume. Parsha Shoftim describes the second Sefer Torah of a Melech. Every Jew has a mitzvah to write a Sefer Torah. Some people in this room may one day fulfill that mitzvah. It takes some money, some effort. You may inherit a Sefer Torah. But the Melech has a mitzvah to write a second Sefer Torah known as Mishnah Torah Hazas. And unlike the first Sefer Torah that every Jew has a responsibility to write, most of us fulfill this mitzvah today based on a Russian Megillah. The Russian Megillah says, Bizman Hazeh, we can fulfill the mitzvah of writing a Sefer Torah by purchasing Svarim. Because the mitzvah, at least according to the Rush, of owning or writing a Sefer Torah is not just symbolic or it's not just ceremonious, it's to learn from a Sefer Torah. In the days of Chazal, before there was a Gemara, you just had one Sefer. You put down a Sefer Torah, you opened the Sefer Torah, you read the Pasuk, and all of Shas came flowing through your imagination because it was an old tradition that you had total recall of. But 2,000 years later, now the Torah Shebaal Peh has evolved into a written document of Svarim, and secondary Svarim, and tertiary Svarim. So we fulfill the mitzvah of writing a Sefer Torah by purchasing Svarim. So tell that to your parents when you're on the phone, asking them for a larger budget for that extra Rashba. My Rebbe said it's a mitzvah. We have to fulfill that mitzvah. Good piece of advice. Buy Svarim now before you have to support a family, and then it's harder to buy Svarim. Now you're buying it when someone else is dying. Obviously, don't do it irresponsibly. Check with your parents. But now's the time to fill your Svarim library. And the truth is really, all joking aside, one of the words I don't like hearing from boys, and it's a terminology shift, but sometimes terminology traps us, is that what books do we need? Books are textbooks that you use for a semester, or even if you use them for the rest of your life, you put them on your shelf and you consult with them every once in a while, unless they're part of your profession. If you're serious about embarking on a lifetime of Talmud Torah, and I hope that everyone here has that ambition, you all see your trajectories in life, it's very different, what you'll become, where you'll live, your profession, your hopes, your dreams, but if there's one common collecting vision in this room, I hope that everyone has some degree of ambition to be a Talmud Chacham, to be someone that knows Torah well and is able to navigate their way through Torah in a coherent and cogent fashion. So these Svarim then become your go-to. You can look at people, I remember of Lichtenstein in this room, would take out his Ksos HaChoshen or his Ramban, and it wasn't a book. He had used it so often that it was just a collection of pieces of paper. He'd pick up the piece of paper, the binding had been shot. There was no cover, there was no back cover. It wasn't even held together. It was just like a folio of pages, and you turn each page one by one. So what I do late at night is I start banging around my Svarim. I toss them against the walls, because even if you're not a Talmud Chacham, it's really important to look like a Talmud Chacham. And to carry a lot of beat-up Svarim under both arms, and you walk the walk seriously.
At least you can fake being a Talmid Chacham. That's something also. That's a mitzvah as well. But seriously, these are Sfarim seriously that I've lived with for the last 35 years of my life. I've learned Gittin several times, and even when I don't learn Gittin, as you'll soon see, when you're learning Gittin and you quote a Gemara in Kiddushin or in Yavamas, you want to look up Yerushalayim and Kiddushin and Yavamas, you pull them off your shelf. So I'd like you to refer to them not as books, but as far. I know it's just terminology, it's semantics, what difference does it make, but it may ring differently. The books you buy, you read, you put it on the shelf, you sell them after the year. The Sfarim are your life, they're part of your connection to Torah. So this Melech has to carry that second Sefer Torah with him wherever he goes. Why must he carry it? Why must he carry it around? Why can't he slot it next to his first Sefer Torah? So you think, well, we're going to skip towards the end, we'll work our way backwards. The High Seimo, the Kohen has to carry the Sefer Torah with him wherever he is. The Parago Kohen Echaya, part Dalet. Why? Leman Yilman. What must he learn? That next Sugya? The next Kosvos, Shifas Rav Elazar, about Yerushin Chutz Lufoni, Rav Eidam Shir Klali. Of course, that's the material. But the goal is, the score is, Laman Yilmad, Liyirat Hashem Alukav, Yer Shamayim, fear of heaven. Not just fear of heaven, humility, modesty. Next Pasuk, Livilti Rum Levavam Yachav, not to be too haughty. Baruch Hashem, we live in a world of democracy. But many of us have realized the limits of democracy and the pitfalls of democracy. Certainly as we've seen democratic systems being shifted in all sorts of grotesque fashions, entertainment value, demagoguery, people who are elected or maybe we agree with their policies, but not necessarily their moral example. And thank God, democracy has alleviated so much human suffering throughout history. We shouldn't celebrate democracy or deify. We don't daven for democracy. One day when Mashiach comes, we're not going to install democracy led by Mashiach as the prime minister. We daven for a benevolent monarchy under the fear of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, where the absolute power isn't abused, but at least can create order and stability and efficiency. But that authority is seen as a conduit of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's authority. So the Melech, who's in that very, very precarious position, on the one hand he's wielding absolute authority, on the other hand it could be abused. And unfortunately, sadly, through the annals of history, absolute authority has more often been abused than it has been implemented in equitable and fair and just fashion. So he carries the Sefer Torah as a corrective, as a check, checks and balances. Shouldn't become too haughty, too arrogant, too vain. Those of you who live in Europe can share with some who haven't been through Europe. Walking through some of these palaces in Europe, it's a sad documentary, it's a sad narrative, how monarchs bled their countries dry for personal indulgence and personal joy and beauty and aesthetics at the cost of literally feeding their subjects. So the king has to carry the Sefer Torah wherever he walks, wherever he goes, as a corrective so that it will translate to Yir Shamayim, it will translate to fear of heaven, it will translate to moral sensitivity, a sense of justice and care and concern. Embedded in this story of the Melech is the recognition that studying Hashem's will is meant to be a holistic transformation of personality. The king's example is meant to check against arrogance and haughtiness and abuse and condescension, but in general, it's meant to launch a holistic personality transformation. We really believe that the Torah is the collective word of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, within a deep immersion and a deep dive into that world of Hashem and an exposure to His will and an encounter of His word is meant to be restorative of human purity, meant to be redeeming, it's meant to lend us dignity, it's meant to create a wholesale change in human character and upgrade human personality. And this is captured by a very famous Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Let's take a look at source number two. Shavu Chachamim Haloshana Mishnah, Rabbi Meir Omer. We'll learn a lot of Rabbi Meir this year. You won't notice that you're learning Rabbi Meir. Very often in life, it's the people who you don't notice that are more important in your life than the people who are flamboyant. You're almost learning Rabbi Meir every day that you're learning a Mishnah. Rabbi Meir was a Talmud of Rabbi Akiva, and he was also a Rebbe of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. And Rabbi Meir had a very, very successful pedagogic style. He was able to articulate ideas with clarity, and with brevity and lucidity. And because of that, when his Talmud of Yehuda Hanasi collected the Mishnah and had to make decisions, because there were hundreds of Tanaim who were teaching more or less the same traditions, so Yehuda Hanasi had to choose which tradition to filter and quote and incorporate as part of the Mishnah, he chose primarily from his Rebbe, Rabbi Meir. So much so, Rabbi Meir forms the backbone of the Mishnah, that whenever Yehuda Hanasi quotes Rabbi Meir, he didn't feel the need to tag it. When he quotes someone else, the 30% of the time he tags it. Well, this is Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. This is Rabbi Tarfon. This is Rabbi Elazar.
but Rabbi Meir forms the backbone of the Mishnah that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi doesn't even bother tagging in, which is why we rule Stan Masnis and Rabbi Meir. Your average garden variety Mishnah that's anonymous is really a teaching of Rabbi Meir. So every day you're sitting in Rabbi Meir's classroom studying from him, you just don't know it because he's anonymous. Some of you will go to Poland this year and you'll visit the grave of the Maharshal. And you may have met and you may see some of the svarim which the Maharshal authored, but one of the most interesting svarim is he methodically went through the Gemara's, the version that we have, and he cleaned up the text and the variant versions, and he decided which was the most authoritative and which was the smoothest to read. And then you'll look at the Maharshal and you'll see it should say this instead of this, and it should say this instead of this, and then you look at your Vilna Shas and it says it already, because the Vilna Shas was based on all this hard work of the Maharshal. So every day you read the Vilna Shas, you're basically driving on the Marshal's highway. And he paved the road. Before the Maharshal, it was a very rocky road. You needed a 4x4 to go through Shas. There were rocks and slips and jumps, and it's very difficult. The Maharshal paved it. So you don't know it, but you're driving on the Maharshal's highway. So Rabbi Meir discussed what impact he expects Talmud Torah to trigger. It should change you. And what's important, and I used the word holistic before, it shouldn't just change you in the classic, everyone think for a moment, a mental experiment. Which five traits do you most immediately associate with religion? Now you'll come up with, probably out of a group of 7 or 8, you'll come up with the same five, but there may be some variances. Piety, hasmada, humility, attentiveness to prayer, tefillah. But it shouldn't just create those changes. It should create wholesale changes. You have to be a better person. If you're an excellent David Hashem, that excellence should express itself in every single facet of your experience. Or else you're containing your Torah to certain recesses and certain isolated compartments of human experience rather than allowing Torah to suffuse your entirety. And Rabbi Meir was aware of the holistic impact that he expected Torah to have. So he said you shouldn't just be more pious, and he discusses piety, but look at Source 2, line 3, you should be a better friend. Nikra Rea, line 3, well, you need to be a better friend. I hope that this year you'll start thinking about what friendship is. Most boys, no disrespect intended, some are different, but most boys your age haven't spent a lot of time thinking about friendship. Friendship doesn't mean sitting and watching the football game with a friend and eating chips. That's called parallel play. You're watching, he's watching, you're sharing chips. Friendship is time, sacrifice, listening, placing yourself into that person's situation, sympathy, identification, empathy, making that person feel like you're listening and you understand their challenges, stepping aside for someone else. In general, girls at this age are a little bit more emotionally mature, and certainly they've thought more about friendship and they work hard to be good friends. And hopefully you'll be able one day to see that as a religious trait. Are you a good friend to your friends? I mean, a simple metric, when you're on the phone, are you talking or are you listening? What's the balance between how long you're talking and how long you're listening? Generally, it's a good metric for how attentive you are to friendship. So this isn't about how well you're learning to tell us, but you're just a better person. Oh, you're the Sabrios. Line number 3, are you a humanitarian or are you a misanthrope? It's very easy to live in today's dark world and to assume that people are all distrustful and deceiving and manipulative. Social media has magnified the voice of the 0.1% of the people in this world who really are conniving and manipulative. Most people are good people, and you should believe in people. I mentioned Reb Lichtenstein, who gave shiur in this room. I sat right where Ari's sitting. That's where I sat. Reb Lichtenstein was in this place. That was my seat for several years. Reb Lichtenstein was a lover of human beings. Reb Lichtenstein was a humanitarian. He believed deeply in human beings, and he trusted human beings. Are you able to trust people and believe in them and not to get swayed by this constant barrage of headlines that present us with the seamy side and the seedy side of our world? Because again, those are the attention grabbers. Those are the people who the media celebrates, magnifies, and amplifies. So you're someone that's oives abrios. Of course, line number 4, malbashto, anava, v'yira, someone that's humble, that's modest, that's quiet. Don't confuse modesty and humility with a trait that he talks about a little bit later, the last line, havitzanua. People sometimes think that tznius is for women, and it determines how long their hemline is. Tznius is privacy. You don't want to draw attention to yourself. You're not looking to play for other people. You're not looking to exhibit yourself. And it draws from the sense that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was in the room, and therefore you act in accordance and obeys. You're not the largest being in that room. Hashem's in that room, and therefore you're a little bit humble. I remember when Reb Lichtenstein was in the room, I felt less than a person. Because I recognized that whatever grandstanding or exhibitionism would be futile, be ridiculous. I've given hundreds, if not thousands, of speeches in my life. The worst speech I ever gave
I don't know if it's been recorded or if it wasn't. Finding out why you tell the worst speech I ever gave was when I was supposed to give a public lecture and I walked into the hall and there was Rav Lichtenstein sitting in the front row. What am I going to do? How am I going to impress him? How am I going to project myself? Every speech is a self-projection. It's like, now for my next act, and I'm performing to a group of magicians. I'm going to pull a rabbit out of a hat. Okay, we know how that trick works. Now for my next act. Where's Peter? I just read the text and I sat down. I couldn't project myself because the awe of seeing how impressive he was compared to my own minuscule attempts was completely crushing. So you don't want Hashem to crush you because Hashem wants your talents to be projected. And to a degree, we'll talk about this as you're projecting yourself. Every projection is a slight turning away from Hashem. And Hashem wants you to turn away for a moment so that you can serve him better. And when you read a Tosus, you're not thinking about a Kodesh Baruch Hu. You're thinking about the analytics and the logic of the Tosus. But Hashem wants you to read the Tosus so that you'll understand him better and then be able to look at him and encounter him in a more deep and profound fashion. So every self-projection has to turn away from Hashem. If you saw a Kodesh Baruch Hu, like we did at Har Sinai, you would almost expire. Chazal tell us that the Jewish people at Har Sinai died. Nafshi yatzah b'dabro imo, our souls alighted, whatever that means, whether they actually died and had to be resurrected, or they exasperated and exhaled and lost their equilibrium and lost their stability, essentially they lost their ability to function because they were so overwhelmed by the presence of their Rav Shlomo. So you're able to be at tzinuah, someone that is really important. I think in today's world, the entire conversation of tzinuah is directed to women and their hemlines. For women, one expression of tzinuah is how they project their own body, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu fashioned the female body in a way that's more attractive than the male body. But it doesn't excuse males from tzinuah's responsibilities. It may not attract, it may not express itself in clothing, expresses itself in other ways. But think about, in a world of social media, in a world of self-promotion, because a lot of social media really is self-promotion, are we losing the tzinuah? We're losing our ability to just be satisfied with no one looking at us. What do you feel like when someone gives a like to one of your posts, or likes one of your notifications on your Twitter posts? Does it make you feel good, or do you not need external gratification? You're self-content. You're happy with your values, the people that you don't have to impress, the people that you lead a more real and authentic life with, even though they don't shower you with applause and adulation. So are you at tzinuah? So Remeir is canvassing a very, very broad range of traits. It's not just how well you learn that Gemara, although it includes that as well. Line number two. Machshar kali asadik v'chassid v'yashar. Yashar, more or less, it means many things. In the Rambam, it means something else, but colloquially, for us, Yashar means, are you a person that's just a straight person of integrity? Some of you may have read Albert Camus, very famous French existentialist, who once said that integrity has no need of rules. If you're someone that has integrity, you don't have to be conditioned or shaped by a rule book. You just know how to behave based on an inner, instinctive sense of nobility, what's right, what's wrong, and you express that integrity. Are you a Yashar? Are you someone that treats people with respect, doesn't try to cut corners? There's a famous story with Rav Amital. Talmud once came to Rav Amital and asked him, Rebbe, I have a real conundrum, a real dilemma. My son was born, let's say, January 10th, whatever it is. If I put down on the birth certificate he was born December 10th, I can get a tax credit because he was born a year early. But then I'll have to enter the army a little bit earlier. If I put down March 10th, then I won't get the tax credit, but I can delay his army cycle by an entire year because the cutoff is March 1st. So I don't know what to do. I was born on January 10th. Should I put down December 10th or March 10th? So Rav Amital said, I have a great solution for you. Why don't you put down January 10th? Because it's right in the middle, and therefore you'll get the best of both. I never thought of that. Incredible solution. Well, you must be a prophet. Never dawned on him just to do the right thing and put down January 10th when the kid was born. And sometimes we're too complicated and over-sophisticated, over-calculating. We'll talk about this a little bit later, just to be a yasha, just to be someone who respects people, respects the law, does what's right, even when it's not a question of enforcement, acts in accordance with human convention. Derech Eretz Kadmon LaTorah essentially means that as much as your Torah creates an idealism, and that idealism takes you beyond this world and should take you beyond this world, it's what idealism is. You don't live a concrete reality, you live a world of ideas and values that are eternal. If someone gets a job, I'm just giving you a concrete example, and that's how I'm trying to decry or to disparage. If someone gets a job being a lawyer, it's not an ideal-based decision. You want to support your family. You need to support your family, and that will last for 50 years you're on this earth, and then you need to support your family. If someone wants to serve a larger ideal, he hopes that those ideals will shape the world far beyond his time on this planet, and he'll be able to create education or progress or welfare or self-care or whatever
whatever ideals are beyond this world. But we're in this world. We have to live in this world. Derech Eretz means you have to accord with the conventions and expectations of this world, even when you're pursuing eternal ideas that surpass time and place and generations. Derech Eretz Kadmon Latar. So Yuriyasha, are you there, wants to know. Are you a wise person? Line number four from the bottom. Vinet or three from the bottom. Vinet and Mimenu, Eitza, Vitushia. We once asked Rav Lichtenstein, very interesting, does he believe in Das Torah? And we assumed that he would say no, because Das Torah is a 20th century convention or invention. You should ask the Gadol or the Rav, Halacha. When it comes to Halacha, his word is immutable. His word is final. That's what rabbinic authority maintains. And certainly ideas that are attached to moral experiences, you should solicit moral cases. One of the challenges in our world, and maybe here's another mental experiment, I don't want anyone to feel like I'm peering at you, but how many adults do you know that don't have any moral voices in their life and they're self-arbitrators? Think about all the adults you know. How many of them, when they face a moral dilemma, they consult with any moral source of information? Hopefully a rabbinic source would be part of that moral equation. And how many people are self-arbitrators? They know what's right. It's a very dangerous place to be. One of the great opportunities, not really opportunities, but one of the great avenues that I felt I lost with Rav Lichtenstein's death was I don't know who I listen to as carefully in my life now, my wife certainly, for moral correction. But I would go to Rav Lichtenstein whenever I faced a moral question, I would listen very, very deeply and masticate and contemplate for 2-3 days. Even if I didn't agree with it, it took me 2-3 days to check myself because I felt so subordinate to his moral authority. I felt like I had to listen really carefully. If I don't understand it, I've got to have to invest and exercise. And if I come to a rejection or an opposition to this position, it has to be thorough and it has to be substantive. It can't just be flippant and quick and impulsive. How many people just don't have that process? They're rash and immediate, and they quickly wash away moral challenges by their own convenience. Or so you say, well, that's wise. So anyway, we asked Rav Lichtenstein, do you believe in Das Torah? And Das Torah is the premise that you should consult with Rabbanim or moral authorities, not just for halacha, in which case their positions are absolutely authoritative, and not just with moral-based questions, in which case you wouldn't hear the Torah's moral voice, but should you consult with the Rebbe about which car to buy, which home to purchase, whether it's undergoing a medical procedure, but areas that are clearly outside the realm of halacha and amoral. There's no moral component to them. And we're shocked. Rav Aaron said, of course he believes in Das Torah. He said he just doesn't think there's anyone in our generation that can wield Das Torah. Because to be able to translate Torah knowledge, not just into halachic adjudication, and not just into moral guidance, but into general affairs of human experience, would take such a vast and deep knowledge of Torah, a Vilna Gaon-type knowledge, or a Navi-type knowledge, which we have long since abdicated and long since abandoned. But in theory, he bought into the notion that, by and large, most people in our community, I don't think, subscribe to. I don't subscribe to it, but Rav Aaron was a very brave thinker, and he corrected us in more of a simplifying and prejudicial thing. Oh, we just don't buy into it. He felt that we should, but we're so far downstream that it's not something we should avail ourselves and we have to proceed or navigate decisions based on non-rabbinic information, which car to buy, which home to purchase. So do you believe that by studying HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Torah, you'll be a wiser person, more thoughtful, better able to give advice, see the world large, see the world whole? If you're interested, there's a book. I think you could probably purchase it in the Gush office. It's a collection of eulogies in English of Rav Lichtenstein. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, the title of the book is Seeing the World Whole and Wide, or Whole World, Large and Wide. It's based, Steady and Whole, thank you. It's based on a quote of one of Rav Lichtenstein's favorite 19th century authors, Matthew Arnold. And if you want to look, Dr. Judah Goldberg in his eulogy quotes Matthew Arnold, and we're able to see the world steady and whole rather than myopic and narrow and tunnel vision. Many people are cyclopses. They see the world through one eye. And cycloptic views can sometimes lead to very imbalanced decisions. We're able to see things with background, with perspective, seeing the flow of history, understanding human nature. So here you have Rabbi Meir giving the anti-Musser agenda or platform. Why do you need to learn Musser? Just study Hashem's Torah. And when you study Hashem's Torah, you will evolve into all of these types of people. And I really hope that part of your moral growth this year will stem, as it should, ideally, will stem from your encounter with the direct word of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that you'll be able to identify HaKadosh Baruch Hu beneath the letters and beyond the text and within the logic, and as you learn more of the system, you'll be able to affiliate it with the other and some divine being, and that will impact whom you are. And as I said before, it won't just impact who you are when you're davening, or when you're learning, or when you're giving tzedakah, or when you're dipping in the mikvah, or ritual-based activities. Well, it will affect whom you are as a human being. It will affect your table manners. It will affect the way you speak to people. It will affect that you're a soft person or a harsh person. It will affect your interpersonal interactions. It will change you as a person. It will change your dreams. It will change, it will filter and infiltrate every precinct of your experience. And that was traditionally the presumption that obviated the need for Musa. Rabbi Saul Salanter claimed that in our modern world, that translation was becoming more and more rare. And people were falling into these traps where they were reading Torah and studying Torah and excelling at Torah without translating it into moral improvement, religious improvement, a deeper connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And hence the idea was we have to dedicate 20 minutes a day, 30 minutes a day to frontal, moral, religious consideration. How do you become a better person? How do you become more humble? How do you become more defendable, more reliable, more honest, greater integrity, whatever those traits. Maybe it's a nice experiment for you tonight to draw 5 traits, but don't be generic or formulaic about it. What are the 5 traits that you need to change in? And don't share it with anyone, because then you'll be a little embarrassed unless you have a really, really good friend. Be honest, look at yourself in that internal mirror. It's really important to step outside of yourself and be able to look at yourself from the outside. Say, what traits can I change in? What can I be better at as a human being? Let's say you weren't in Gush. Let's say you were in Harvard or something. I would still ask that question. What traits? Now, some of them may be unique to Gush. You'd be better masmid, keep halacha better, daven better, but some of them may just be existential. Who am I as a person? And how can I become better as a person? Anger, a lot of boys your age have issues with anger. Your anger flares, your temper flares. How do you manage your anger? How do you deal with anger? Jealousy, pettiness, cynicism. We'll talk about that a little bit later. If you go back in a history, a time machine, to 1983, to this room, Ari, and try to find me, you may be able to find me because I gave you a little cheat sheet about where I sat. But if you didn't have that, you probably couldn't find me. Because you'd be looking for a shrunken version of who I am today. And you wouldn't be able to identify me because I'm totally different than the person I was walking into this building. And I'm not proud of the traits that HaKadosh Baruch Hu blessed me with naturally, because those he delivered. I'm not proud of the fact that I'm tall. Hashem just made me tall. I suffer on airlines, but I can reach the top shelf in my kitchen. Okay, trade-offs. Everything in life is trade-offs. I'm supremely proud of the traits that HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't endow me with. And at different stages of my development, I was able to identify them. I had the courage to acknowledge the deficiencies, because sometimes we protect ourselves with a narrative of self-defense and self-delusion. It's always important to protect yourself, because sometimes if you look at yourself too strongly in the mirror, it becomes very overwhelming. But at certain points, when you're ready for it, when you're ready for that veneer to be shattered, say, wow, you really have to improve in this area. You have these wake-up moments. Remember, I had a wake-up moment. I'm not going to tell you the particular trait, but my mother came to visit me. She was staying in a hotel with my aunt. And I was sleeping, but I really wasn't sleeping. I wasn't trying to fool anyone. I was in and out of my sleep, and I heard my mother and my aunt speaking about me in ways that were very, very hurtful to me. They weren't trying to be hurtful. They were just saying, why does he have this trait? Why does he behave that way? And no one ever shared that with me. And for 2-3 days, I was devastated. And then I made a decision not to be devastated. They're right. They love me. My mother and my aunt, they're no accident. It's not my friend or my competitor. They absolutely love me. And if I'm expressing this, what must other people be expressing? And that was a wake-up moment for me, and I decided I want to work really hard at changing that trait. A good way to change a trait is very often to associate with people who possess that trait. And I hope that over the course of this year, you'll start to build friendships, not just based on mutual paths and who's cool and who you're learning with and who's in your share, but you'll gravitate to people who exhibit certain behavioral traits that you're trying to osmotically absorb. And by being in their presence, you say, oh, this is the way they do it. This is the way they become that person, and I can try to train myself to become a better person. So that's what we're here for Wednesday nights at 6:15. That's what we're here for, hopefully, the first 20, 25 minutes of your Seder. Take some time to think about these issues, read what people have written, read what the Rosh Hashivas have written about, and hopefully to become an excellent person in every walk of life. If not, again, I said it before, if you contain Torah to certain components of personality and you do not allow them to bleed or to wash into your entire persona, you're stifling the impact Torah can have on you. Ideally, someone who's a Ben Torah should be a Ben Torah and Oved Hashem in every aspect, even to the point, and I don't want you to take this, I'm just giving you as an example, I'm not necessarily expecting you to follow through on this execution, if it's an example to open your mind. Someone once asked Rabbi Lichtenstein, Rabbi, I'm already in my senior year in college. I've already been accepted to whatever was medical school. Now it's finals time, and the finals will have no professional impact on my life. I can get a D or an A. What should I do? I don't remember, there are two versions to the story, and no one should take this as a psak, because if I get a D, then I can spend more time in the base matter. So maybe I should flunk the test or just get by with a minimal passing grade and spend more time learning. There were two replies to this question, and it has to be calibrated. I'm not saying you have to buy into this conclusion, but it should be calibrated by all these factors. On the one hand, you're right, you have more time available for learning. On the other hand, you made a bond of trust, and a covenant of trust with the teacher. You don't expect the teacher to walk away midstream, so you committed to that teacher. And that commitment means you've got to perform at some level out of loyalty and honesty and integrity. The teacher's expecting you to test is just the method, the metric to gauge your investment and your performance, but you have a relationship with that teacher that has to be acknowledged. And the other version of the story, which is just as compelling, is if you're Bentari, you have to be excellent in everything. And mediocrity is contagious. And if you intentionally act in a mediocre fashion, it's going to start to wash into other aspects of your life. And that's a very delicate decision, because on the other hand, you could be studying ancient Chinese dynasties or learning the Rush. It's a very, very compelling argument for learning the Rush. But at some level, you have to calibrate these aspects, because that's part of being a Bentari. Part of being a Bentari is trying to be as excellent a person as you can, and as honest a person as you can, and as loyal a person, not to be dishonest. So that's what we're here for, 6:15 every Wednesday night. We'll choose sections in the Parsha. Obviously, this isn't a Parsha Shir in the way that Rabbi Leibtag will teach you exegesis and reading texts, and there are other times for that. And the Parsha is just a platform to select ideas that are important. I do hope to try to itemize 20 to 25 core issues of identity, moral behavior, theology. This isn't deep theology. We're not going to dive deep into the world of theologians and medieval Rabbeinu Kreskos and the Rambam. There are other shirim for that, but the basic tenets of belief, to give you a sense of what, why I believe, how to express that belief, how to be a better person. This will especially kick into high gear in Sefer Bereishis after Yom Tov, because those are really the 10, 12 parshas that build the cornerstones of identity, of moral behavior, of moral capacity. The others were meant to serve as role models and myself as similar upon him. But let's just start before Yom Tov by trying to highlight some of the moral aspects or the behavioral aspects we'd like to improve upon. I want to start with one which, to me, is a crucial issue for anyone, a crucial issue for people your age, and certainly a crucial issue for people your age who are learning the yeshiva at Har Tzion. Source number one, Moshe Rabbeinu reforms Am Yisrael, you're entering Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael is a land that's saturated with wizardry and necromancy and sorcery and people who are stargazers and soothsayers, and this is the world of Shakespeare and Hamlet and apparitions and Ketabah, Laretz. Of course, it's not the world of Shakespeare, and my apologies to the Englishman, but it's the world that resembles the stories. People who sacrifice their children, source number one, part one. Kosim, Psamim, magicians, wizards, Maonain, soothsayers, necromancers, people who evoke the dead, seances, Ouija boards. With the whole scene. Chaver, chaver, shal, ovi, yidoni, b'dari, shal, amesim. Ki to'avas Hashem, kolo se'ela, u'beglala, to'avot se'ela, Hashem, l'kecha, marisha, sami, panach. These are despicable, they're abominable, they're undignified, the blood, the darkness, the magic, the death. These are obviously worlds that even if we didn't have a mitzvah to avoid, we'd want to avoid to ensure the dignity of the human condition. Man of reason, man of light, versus man of darkness and enchantment and wizardry and manipulation. So clearly this is a world that we're meant to avoid, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu finds them abominable. And then there's a conclusive pasuk. Source number one, part one, Tamim Tihyeh Im Hashem Elokecha. Very simple, unadorned, quiet pasuk. Tamim Tihyeh Im Hashem Elokecha. Now, in the context of this pasuk, the Ramban's pshat probably makes the most sense. Instead of diversifying your interests amongst HaKadosh Baruch Hu and sorcery and wizards, focus your attention completely on HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his delivery mechanism for information, namely Nevuah, which emerges in the next section. Namely, Tamim here means complete, whole. Se Tamim means a sheep that has no blemish, completely whole. So the Ramban writes, instead of one day soliciting Hashem, and then the next day soliciting a magician, and then the third day awakening the dead, focus on HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Sheni Yachay Levaveinu, a love Levado, line number three, and not only that, not just that we have an alternate delivery system that we can consult Levian, but also that the future is ours to shape. The future will be a product of our behavior. Rather than trying to predict the future and be obsessed with the future, we shape the future. So there are two reasons we don't consult with this entire world of black magic. A, because we have Nevi'im, but also because we don't see the future as predetermined. The world of magic and the world of Calvin sometimes converge. We see the future as open, and we'll shape it. So instead of worrying about what tomorrow will bring, I'll shape tomorrow by studying Torah, performing good deeds, and being a better person. Closer to Kodesh Baruch Hu. Last line in the Ramban, V'namin shekol ha'baos, whenever that future occurs, tiyana kapit karev adam ha'vodasa. Instead of wasting your time obsessing about tomorrow, try to shape tomorrow in a way that you find favorable, and that you expect tomorrow to be shaped. But the Ibn Ezra, and I apologize, Rashi also has a very different read on Tamim. And it's closer to our colloquial interpretation of Tamim. When we talk about someone who's a Tamim, we typically refer to someone that doesn't ask questions, that just accepts things. That all these people described in Parsha Shoftim are people that are worried about the future, and they don't understand the future, and they want to analyze the future, and the data that they want to solicit about the future is provided through magic and wizardry. Then we can begin to analyze if I've been given a bad omen, then how will I shape or reshape my reality tomorrow to respond to that, to defend against that? Tamim Tiyam Hashem Elokeinocha means not to be over-analytical, not to worry about that, but to accept certain confidences and promises on blind faith. As Ibn Ezra says, Tamim Tiyam Hashem Elokeinocha Shalot Tishal, La Mamila. Remember, the first employment of the new Tamim is in Parshas Vayera. Hisalech Lefanai, really Parshas Lech Lecha. Hisalech Lefanai Vayei Tamim. And in that context, if Kodesh Baruch Hu isn't cordoning Avram away, steering him away from wizards, in that context, Avram is befuddled by the Mila. We'll talk about this in Parshas Vayera. What does Avram find so baffling about Mila that the Kodesh Baruch Hu has to assure him, Hisalech Lefanai Vayei Tamim? But certainly in that context, the Ibn Ezra's pshat and Rashi's pshat, you can take a look at Rashi. I apologize, I didn't get a chance to quote Rashi. Don't ask too many questions, except the Kodesh Baruch Hu's will and wisdom in ways that you may not be able to decipher or to decode properly. So according to the Ibn Ezra, according to Rashi, the opportunity to be a Tamim sets up a clash between two methodologies of experience. One is analysis, thinking, and one is accepting, celebrating, confidence, indulging in someone's assurances rather than having to be analytical about whatever realities we're going to accept. Now that's an important theological issue, and we'll talk about that at great length, especially in Parshas Vayera, when we talk about Avram front and center. But I want to talk about something related, which also falls under the category of Tamim. It's not about that fault line between analysis and acceptance in a theological realm, but that fault line between analysis and acceptance in an interpersonal realm. And that's the fault line that if we veer too wildly from, leads us into a very, very dangerous world. And that's the world I want to try to guard you against. And that's the territory that we call cynicism. Every person, idea, organization in this world has a flaw. This is not a perfect world. No human being you'll ever meet is perfect. No system you'll ever meet is perfect. We're restructuring our world with the shattered glass that lays beyond our feet. We're not angels, we're human beings. Our world is fissured. One strategy is to just celebrate ideas, people, see the positive, let that influence you and shape you, and you can indulge your belief and your support, and you can feel empowered by it. And that's the root of Tamim, just accepting. You could paralyze, just to use a common expression, paralysis by analysis, you can paralyze or hamstring any positive person, idea, or organization by locating the flaw, the deficiency, the defect. And that leads into a very, very dangerous world of cynicism and sarcasm. It is true that every negative trait, except for one, is not prohibited in the Torah. There's no issur to be jealous. There's an issur to act on jealousy. That's called a tigzol. Kill someone because you're jealous. There's no issur to be angry. There are various issurim that could emerge from anger, hitting someone, abusing someone. There may be one trait which is essentially forbidden. That may be the trait of arrogance, based on the pasuk v'ram levavacha v'shachachta Hashem Elokecha, even if the arrogance isn't expressed. It may be inherently prohibited. But it's generally true that traits are not prohibited, and since they're not prohibited, they don't carry punishment. There's no punishment for being jealous. Why? Because it's always true that the trait is its own punishment. What's the punishment for being angry? Hashem doesn't have to concoct the punishment, a legal administrative punishment. You say, I want to just close the door. Anyone who walks in, please close the door. The punishment for being jealous is you spend your entire life seething with envy. And you're unable to appreciate all the opportunities, faculties that the Rebbe Shalom delivered to you, because it's tautologically true, it's axiomatic, that whatever you need to succeed, Hashem provides for you. Maybe not immediately available, but you may have to dig deeper and to be able to tap into resources and wellsprings you may not be aware of. And sometimes a nisayon and a challenge opens up certain wellsprings and it allows you to excavate the layers that you weren't able to draw upon before. But you're so obsessed with that other person. I remember about 20 years ago, in the early twos, in Houston. Houston had a financial surge. It was based on the energy sector. And there were terrible scandals, graft and corruption, and people skimming millions of dollars. It's called the Enron scandal. So they interviewed some of these execs who were about to be tossed into prison for 20, 30 years. And the interviewer asked a very poignant question. He said, I just don't understand. You have to explain something to me. You have hundreds of millions of dollars in your hedge fund. Enough money to spend your rest of your life in absolute luxury, your life, your children's life, your grandchildren's life. Why did you feel compelled? Take such a great risk, and now you're going to spend 20, 30 years of your prime locked up in jail, incarcerated. And I found his response haunting, but very, very identifiable. He said, it wasn't about what I had. The other person had more than me. And I needed to outpace him and compete with him. So therefore, I had to perform financial acrobatics just to earn the next 20 million to put myself over the edge. And it was just a stark reminder of how dangerous jealousy can become. This person will never enjoy all their money and all their riches because of jealousy. And Hashem doesn't have to punish us because they're toxic and they consume our lives. And what's the punishment for being angry? You've met people who are constantly angry. And angry is a disquiet of the soul. And when the soul is ruptured, and when the soul is fissured, and when the soul is in chaos, creativity can't emerge. If you guys are really looking to be creative, the first step is to have inner calm. Without inner calm, there's no grounds for creativity. Creativity has to have a baseline. Anyone playing a musical band? Right? So there's the guitar, and the drums, and the wind instruments, and there's a bass guitar. You don't notice the bass guitar. It's a marshal in every rock band, right? You don't notice the bass, Rabbi Meir, but you know, Rabbi Meir would probably play bass guitar if you were in a rock band. It just keeps the rhythm, keeps the beat. And it's a bass line that serves as a counter and a contrast to musical expressions. And it's true in music, and it's true in art, and it's true in human creativity. And without that bass line of what I would expect the idea to be, and now I can contrast it with how the idea actually appears, and I can try to create meaning based on that deviance and discrepancy, there's no creativity. It has to be an inner calm, it has to be at peace with yourself and at peace with your world. And if you're constantly immersed in a world of anger and confrontation and contentiousness and argument and discord, your whole world is defined by mayhem and chaos and lack of quiet, you won't perform anything creative, whether that's art or whether that's just simply creating souls and shaping people, because you're always in a tumult. There's never stability, there's never equilibrium. And the same is true with cynicism. When you start to negate people, there are certain people that should be negated. I mentioned before, everyone is flawed. When those flaws are large and dramatic, then that leads to hypocrisy. When the difference, I hope that if, let's say, you came to my house to visit me, you would more or less find the same person, I hope. Maybe dressed a little different, maybe I'm in my work clothes, maybe I'm rolling around with my grandchildren on the floor, but it dug deeply, I hope you find more or less the same person. There may be some differences, but more or less. When the difference between the mask people wear in public and their true identity is too vast, that's called hypocrisy, where there's absolutely no correlation. They're one person when they present themselves to others, and they're a different person in their own reality. Most people are not hypocritical. Most people just have differences. We have different personas, different identities, who you are in the classroom and who you are in the basketball court and who you are. And as you grow older, you're trying to consolidate and unify to be one person, which is really the definition of integrity. Integrity we treat as a moral value. In theory, a criminal could also have integrity. A chainsaw murderer kills wherever they are, whether they're in the backyard or in the dining room or in the shul, they'll always kill someone with a chainsaw. that person has integrity because they're the same person. Okay, we typically use the word integrity to refer to moral aptitude and moral fitness and moral consistency. But you know what happens to a person who's cynical and sarcastic. You start to negate people in your life, and then what happens is the noose starts to tighten because you're less interested in people, and they move out of your life, and then you start to direct your cynicism and your dismissiveness towards people closer to you, who you know better, obviously. You know your siblings and your parents and one day your children and your friends much better, so it's much easier to be cynical about them. And then, of course, you run out of subjects for your negative cynicism, and there's really only one subject left, and that's the person you know really well, and that's yourself. And then you become a cynical old man who doesn't believe in himself or in this world, and you've met that person, and the world is out to get you, and there's no one that can ever redeem this world. It's a fallen world. And then you're really locked into a very, very quiet and bitter prison of cynicism. And this is a general danger. And it's even more acute and more aggravated in people who are smart. And it's no incident, or it's not incidental, it's inherent. A couple of years ago in the New York Times, they reported upon a study in which they were able to trace the source of cynicism to a particular part of the brain. I forget which part of the brain, but they're able to say this is when they mapped it, and when someone's being cynical, they saw that part of the brain firing. They saw the thermal rays in that part of the brain. And it turned out that smart people, intellectual people, had a larger part of that brain mass. That part was larger because some people are not over analytical and they just see good things and favorable people and they just are excited by it. And they allow themselves, excuse my cliches and my kimbayu, but they allow themselves to be affected by the positive energy, by the positive feeling. That's fantastic. That's great. I wish I could be. And smarter people tend to be over analytical. They're always looking for, well, what's wrong with it? And what's deceptive about it? And how can I really discover its inner hypocrisy or its inner flaw? And it's really important for wise people to check themselves against it. You don't want to be naive. You don't want to be exploited by your naivete. You want to be able to see the world in real terms. And how do you draw the line between not being naive, being wise, analyzing situations, but not falling into that trap of cynicism? How do you manage that fault line, not in the world of theology, between being a tamim and analyzing the future, but in your interpersonal relationship and being a tamim? So it's meaningless. You accept people and you're happy for people and try to find the good and favorable in people. Mirza Shem, in about 2 weeks, we'll start the Yud Gimel Midos HaRachamim. One of the Yud Gimel Midos HaRachamim is Rav Chesed. Rav Chesed doesn't mean Hashem is a Hasidish Rebbe, or he's a Rebbe that delivers food for Tom Cheshavis. Rav Chesed means that when Hashem judges us, he judges us, I won't say prejudicially, but favorably. He basically slants the process in our favor. And there are many different ways in which he slants the process in our favor, but let's just study one of them. Look at the back page. It's a separate section, but I want to connect them a little bit because we're running out of time. Okay, in the back section, Vayavar Hashem al panav vayikra, source 3, Hashem, Hashem, the back of page 1, Kelachim v'chanon erach hapayim v'rav chesed. So there are many different interpretations of Rav Chesed, and of course they're complementary. It's not one strategy or one scheme. But one of the schemes, source number 4, is a medrash. Shirumate klape chesed. Hashem tilts the process towards chesed. Mate klape chesed. What does that mean? Line 4, source 4, line 1. Nistakel b'tov v'lo b'ra. Come on, you all have this voice in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Hashem, I may be this, and I may be this, and I may be this, and those are embarrassing, and those are mortifying, but I'm also this, and I'm also this, and look at my positive traits. Or sometimes the voice is even more stark. I may have failed, but this is my year. I'm going to turn it around. I'm in yeshiva. Give me a chance to show you what I can become. Basically, you're leveraging your performance against your potential. Say, my achievements may be underwhelming, but my potential is so high, allow that potential a little chance to blossom and to grow. And sometimes we judge ourselves by our potential, and we judge other people by their achievements, when it really should be the opposite. We judge ourselves by our achievements and be favorable and generosity of spirit. Something called generosity of funds. You give your funds, you give your food, you give your time. There's something called generosity of spirit. And hopefully you'll learn about what that means. And imagine you have a spirit in you. And how can you be generous with that spirit? One way of being generous with that spirit is being forbearing to people and trying to understand, to grade them on the curve, see the entire package, not necessarily to highlight their negative traits. Whenever you see part of a situation, it's easier to magnify that situation or walk away with a negative association. When you look at the entire package, the entire body of work, so if you ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to be judged based on your favorable potential, not based on your underwhelming achievements, well, it really depends on what type of world you create for yourself. These things are all reciprocal. If you create that world, that's the way you treat other people, that's your life. It's not just Hashem rewards you. You've carved out. Hashem treats you based on the reality you've carved out. Karis is not a punishment. Karis just means you've carved out a reality where you're incompatible with the next world. The next world will not have money, will not have clothing, will not have food, will not have sports, will just be spiritual. It'll just be eternal souls thirsting for the word of HaKadosh Baruch Hu on the encounter. So a person who spends their entire life indulged in the world of material, when all that expires, they're cut off from the next world because they just don't fit. Is it a punishment? It doesn't excise or truncate your eternity. It would be like taking your American plug and trying to fit it into an Israeli socket. It just doesn't fit. It doesn't, it's a square peg into a round hole. So a person has absolutely no spiritual consciousness and the next world is simply cut off. There's no address, no landing place, no compatibility. So you create your reality. Hashem doesn't punish you. Hashem basically works within the reality you create. Pasuk says in Parashas B'chakasa, if you create a world of cause and effect, then Hashem treats you to that world of cause and effect. If you create a world which is based on serendipitous randomness and everything just happens on its own, and there's no cause and effect, then Hashem says, if you paint the world as incidental and lack of causality, what happened is in no way based on your behavior, then I'll treat you that way. That's a worse fate than being punished because the world is completely random and fearful and overwhelming. So if you treat people by always accentuating a positive phrase, then it says, well, that's the world you live in. So that's how you're graded. You're graded based on the index you've created. If you create a world of highlighting negative traits, then... So this is one of the traits I'd like you to think about. I plead with you to think about because, let's face it, we all like a good joke. And sometimes cynicism and sarcasm gets people's attention and makes us feel good about ourselves. I have to tell you, I have an aversion to going to stand-up comedians. I can't go anymore. I enjoy a good joke just like the next place. I just can't do it. I just feel like it's such a morally baseless environment. There are a couple comedians I like listening to. Basically, comedy that's self-effacing. And I'd like those of you who are more comic in your interactions to learn that. So you're a better comedian than others. And creating humor and good comedy is an important trait to lighten the spirit, to break the ice, to break tension. It's very important. But can you redirect some of that comedy to your own expense or just to abstract ideas or to people close to you when they know you're not looking to insult them or hurt them? Think about yourself. If you have a penchant for comedy, is it at someone else's expense? And are the shows you're watching at someone else's expense? Is the comedy, there's certain comedy that feels pure and it's just making fun of ourselves and our lives and our conditions, and sometimes it's really stingy. And if you train yourself and you're exposed to too much of it so often, the only filter we apply to the movies and television we watch is the level of nudity and the type of language, which in and of themselves are important, but there has to be a content-based filter. You can't just watch programs and movies that are clean, but whose baseline value system are just so antithetical to the types of values you're trying to build. So really be careful about that. I know a lot of you, for example, I just quote this example, A, I may be dating myself, A, and I also may be not insulting you, but saying something which is abrasive. But just use this as an example. A lot of people in the early 2000s, late 90s watch Seinfeld. It's clean. There's no nudity. But what are the values of that show? What are the values being expressed? Indolence, manipulation, making fun of people's bodies, making fun of... Where it's a constant stream of exploitation and cynicism and getting away with as little as possible and breaking the law and cutting the corners. Okay, so at some point, maybe you'll tell yourself, I'm above that. I'm already morally committed to who I am. I can watch at a distance, which is fine. You want to watch at a distance, but just be careful. Just make sure you're watching at that distance rather than indulging in that world and speaking like those people and taking their terminology and acting like the people you see on stage, because then it can seep into you. So, Tam Tiam Hashem Elokecha, again, in this context in Parsha Shoftim, it's more theological, whether we veer into the world of wizardry, black magic, sorcery, or into the world of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's nevuah, or that belief in the future being undetermined. But in a general sense, it's, and I'd like to be able to borrow and extrapolate from one realm to another. The deeper you understand an idea, the more you can flex it and exploit it somewhere else. So take this idea and map it from the world of theology and how we determine our future. Map it to your world of interpersonal relationships. And just know,
many people in this room, I would think, and I don't know you well enough, honestly, I'm not looking at anyone's eyes and trying to peer into your soul and determine who is. If there are 60 or 50 people sitting in this room, I imagine that 20 to 25 of you will have to face this challenge. And I just really encourage you, the sooner you face it, the better off you'll be. And start to face it almost by containing the expressions. If you feel a cynical idea, try to curb it and not express it. At some point, you can transform yourself. This element is not cynical, as I said before, by understanding the trait, but primarily by having people, in addition to your friends, who just are wholesome, believing, supportive people. And you'll find those people when you'll hear someone say something, wow, that's so great! And you'll ask yourself, but it isn't. Aren't you thinking about this? Don't you understand that? That's your moment. Then you're right at that floor line. That person evidently is more wholesome, less cynical, and by interacting with that person, you can change your own calibration. You don't become that person, but you can recalibrate yourself as to whom you are by spending more time with that person who's more of a believer and an endorser than a rejecter and a dismissal. And that's how you make a personality change. Everyone in this room probably, if you're sitting in the gush, I don't have to stop here, but everyone in this room is bright. Hopefully over the course of the year, you'll realize that that comes with handicaps. And you've been celebrated throughout high school as being the brightest kid in the class and the valedictorian. That's not real character. It doesn't make a difference how many brain cells you have. Who you are as a person, who you are internally. And one of the dangers that bright people face is attention towards cynicism, the ability to paralyze or to analyze, and yield dismissiveness based on their analysis. Okay, stop here. Everyone have a good dinner.